I thought I could take this idea that it's comfortable, that it's glamorous, that it's mostly soft, that it's not, you know, structured clothing, and really, you know, go much, much further with it.
Hi, I'm Sylvia Beckerman. Join me today as I talk to an extraordinary woman who is changing the world by making a difference in her life and the lives of those around her.
Hi, I'm Liz Lang. I'm the founder of Liz Lang Maternity and currently the owner of Fig Women's Clothing. And welcome to Sylvia and me.
Liz, I'm so happy that you found the time in your not so busy life to be with me here today. Let's see. You are a serial entrepreneur. You put breath into maternity, into caftans, into gray gardens. You're a podcast host, Just Enough Family. I don't know whether I said you're an author. If I did before, I'm allowed to be repetitive. Your book is Liz Lang's Maternity Style, How to Look Fabulous During the Most Fashion-Challenged Times. In addition, you're a member of the famous Steinberg family.
Yep,
which we'll go into, we'll touch on a little bit later.
Sure.
But your story is fantastic because you created something that you saw a need for when you didn't even need it.
That's true.
And we'll go back to the start of Liz Lang Maternity, because before that, you were an assistant in Vogue, at Vogue, which in listening to you talk about that, it was, you did this, you did that, but it wasn't anything phenomenal. Right. Tell us about meeting this young designer and deciding that there was something else you could do with his clothing.
So, you know, it was the mid-90s. As you said, people always get it wrong, but you got it right. I was not pregnant myself. I hadn't been pregnant yet. Today, I have two children. They're 25 and 23, but this was prior to that. And I was young, you know, my mid to late 20s. And I had been working at Vogue. I met this designer. I decided that I really wanted to go work for him. I really liked what he was doing, and I wanted to experience that. While I was there, I learned a lot because he didn't have a big budget, and it was just the two of us and one other guy, and we just all kind of did everything, and what we couldn't do or didn't know how to do, you kind of had to figure out. But he was struggling, always struggling. And it was at sort of that time, that pregnancy time in my life, all my friends were starting to get married and have babies. I myself was newly married and thinking about babies. And I noticed that a lot of my friends would come to our offices and they would just sort of squeeze, if they were pregnant, they would squeeze themselves into some of the things that this designer was wearing. And I had this like twofold aha moment. One was they look better, sort of squeezed into something. They look thinner, they look better, they look more quote unquote normal than they do in the maternity clothing that they walk in wearing, which is typically was typically back then extremely oversized and extremely baby-ish in its styling, you know, like
you mean with a big bows and
bows and pastels. And this was the 90s. Things were very clean. It was about, you know, black Calvin Klein and navy pantsuits and looks like that. So it really made no sense. And when I said to them, why don't you just shop at maternity stores? They'd say, oh, I can't find anything. You have no idea. We're spending all this. I'm spending all this money on all this designer clothing that has stretch in it that I don't even want to spend the money on, but I have nothing to wear and I'm working and I don't know what to do. So I was like, wow. So it's this like captured market. They don't seem to have a good resource. They will buy anything because they're desperate. And so I said to this designer, because I wasn't a designer. I had graduated from Brown University with a degree in comparative literature. I was not a designer. I said, you know, I think you could turn your business around if you didn't change anything about your designs, just after your name, instead of just your name on the label, just put the word maternity, like just see what happens. He thought I was out of my mind. It wasn't a sexy category at the time. No one was talking about it. Celebrities weren't talking about being pregnant. Just he didn't want to do it. But I, like so many entrepreneurs I've discovered now in hindsight, had that classic entrepreneur moment where I would just be up all night thinking about it. I couldn't stop thinking about this idea. And I just said, you know what? I have to do it. So somehow I went out on my own. I mean, the story could go on and on, yeah. But I went out on my own, with not a lot and, you know, not really knowing much. And I designed a few pieces and I sold them to my friends. And I figured I would do that as a very small, fun thing to do until I got pregnant myself. And then I probably wouldn't work at all. That's honestly what I thought. But it took off in a way that I could never have expected, just beyond my wildest dreams. And, you know, when I sold the brand 10 years later, it was, and again, I'm not bragging, but it was in sales, a multi-hundred-million-dollar brand in sales. It was the second largest maternity apparel brand in the United States. And I ended up selling it to private equity for a lot of money.
I want to go back just a little bit. And you mentioned celebrity. And one of the things that we know is that we always look at celebrities and look to see what they're wearing. But, and you know, it wasn't something that you wanted to see what they were wearing when they were pregnant. They usually weren't around, but you flipped that. You flipped that with Cindy Crawford.
That's exactly right. You've really done your homework. So I thought to myself, having worked at Vogue and just knowing how the world works, well, everyone cares about what celebrities are wearing and that sells clothing, but nobody is talking about all these female pregnant celebrities. They must be getting pregnant, even though they just show up one day with babies. We know they went through a pregnancy.
In two beds like Lucille Ball?
Exactly. But back then, I don't even know if it was like prudish. It was just nobody was interested. And so they would just kind of hide out for those 9 months that they were pregnant. And, you know, like no one was just, it was just very different time. So I decided that anytime I heard a celebrity was pregnant, which wasn't so easy back then, this was pre-internet, but I would, if I heard by reading in People Magazine or Us Weekly or the stuff we used to do back in the 90s that someone was pregnant, no matter how A-list they were, and Cindy Crawford, as you mentioned, was as A-list as you could get back then. She was a super model. I heard she was pregnant, so I found a way to reach out. And again, I just want to be clear, I did not know these celebrities. I had no connection to them. But, you know, back then you could get, and you still could do it today with some hard work, you could get the name of someone's publicist, the name of someone's assistant. I did that every time I heard a celebrity was pregnant. I would say to their publicist or assistant, can I send them some clothing or do they want to come to my office and see what I'm doing? And they always said yes, because they had no options, even though in their non-maternity life, they had every designer in the world trying to dress them. None of these designers were trying to dress them when they weren't pregnant. So I kind of had the entire marketplace to myself. So when I say that I had an A-list celebrity roster, it was crazy. Like I had, you know, absolutely everybody. In fact, again, this isn't even the most A-list, but just for example, when I saw that Kelly Ripa was trying out, she was trying out to be Regis's co-host, but she was pregnant and I knew who she was from All My Children. I reached out to her. No one really knew who she was. I reached out to her and said, I'll dress you for that tryout. She was thrilled. And then she, of course, got the gig. I ended up dressing her every single morning. I go to the ABC studios every morning when she got it throughout all the pregnancies she had afterwards. And she would talk about it on the show. And these celebrities were great. They would all mention it when people asked what they were wearing. Cindy Crawford had a gig on Good Morning America that was weekly. She'd open up her closet and she'd say, look at all these cute clothes by this woman in New York named Liz Lang. Plus she did a People Magazine story with me. I mean, it went on and on, everybody. So wow. I ended up throwing Brooke Shields' baby shower. I threw a baby shower for Brooke Moynihan, who at the time was going to get married to Tom Brady. But yeah, it became a thing that just took off,
It took off a life of its own. And I wish you were around when I was pregnant in the 80s. I'll never forget the last thing I bought before I went into labor was the most god-awful pair of maternity jeans.
Yeah, no, it was really awful.
I mean, so, really bad.
Yeah, so I kind of turned it around by making normal clothing, and it was a very exciting and fun ride.
All right, we're going to talk about the business thing, but I want to jump into what took place after you sold it. You were on you had the brand for about another 18 years with Nike and Target. And then came the pandemic. And you were walking around, maybe it was a little bit before, you were walking around, people were outside, whether they were walking or jogging, they're usually in sweatsuits. You, on the other hand, were in caftans, very nice and comfortable. There's nothing, you know, scrunching you in on the waist and whatnot. And you're walking in caftans. And the label is called Fig.
Right. So what happened? Oh, sorry, go on.
And you had people coming up to you and saying, wow, how fantastic. What did you do after that?
Okay, so you're right. So I end up, I sell the maternity brand and I end up doing a whole line on Home Shopping Network, not maternity, called Completely Me by Liz Lang, which I did for 10 years, plus Liz Lang for Target, as you mentioned, lived on at Target for a long time and I was the face of that brand. But the pandemic hits. It coincidentally is the time that our Target contract has run out. I have sold the rights to do maternity clothing anymore. Besides that, my life has moved on. My children are in their teens at this point. I'm not thinking very much about maternity clothing. I've entered my caftan years. Pandemic hits. I'm at our house in Florida. We are from New York. I'm from New York City, but we have a home in Palm Beach. And like so many, we end up spending COVID in Palm Beach. In Palm Beach, you could walk outside and stuff. The weather was gorgeous. And as you said, I'm walking in these caftans that I really like. Instead of wearing the sweatsuits that I've been wearing when we were, you know, locked down in the New York area where it was very cold. It was very, very hot in Florida that winter, broiling hot season. And I found these caftans were much more comfortable. They were cooler. And yes, I'd walk on what we call the trail here in Palm Beach and people would stop me and they'd be like, oh my God, you look so fabulous. And in my mind, I was thinking like, I look fabulous. This was easier than probably the two-piece sweatpants that they got themselves into this morning. I just threw on this like schmata and my flip-flops. And you're right. And I look good. I look like, you know, I've like put a lot of effort into this, but it's the pandemic. I have not. So it was a brand called Fig that I was a huge fan of. I had no connection to this brand other than I wore a lot of it. I liked a lot of it. So in a weird, like, you know, almost like meant to be, you know, Becher type thing, I found out through the grapevine that Fig, like so many brands during COVID, sadly, was going under, that the founder was sort of just done and that it was maybe going to be for sale. So I bought the brand. I was looking for my next act anyway. I was sort of debating, am I going to start a new brand as I'd done always in the past? Am I going to acquire a brand? And then this brand became for sale. So I acquired it, as you mentioned. And that was 3 years ago. And since then, I've kind of worked on evolving it. I'm hoping we've done a good job from a brand that was mostly known for caftans and resort wear. And I still love that. And that's still very much part of the brand's DNA. I think we still do incredible caftans. But now we do so many other things. We do dresses, we do separates, we do pants and skirts and blouses and knitwear. And I don't think it's just for when you happen to be in a resort community like Palm Beach, because like so many of my friends and so many people now where the world has gotten so much more mobile, we live in a lot of places and I live in New York City and I also live in Palm Beach. And
well, it's been called, or you've been called, the playground for colorful characters to live, dine, dance, and explore. They're curious, they're carefree, they're dreamy, they're modern, they're energized, and they're unconventionally sophisticated.
That's a very good description of Fig. Yes, yes.
And you're not just making it, from what I understand, you're putting in some knitwear so that it's not just a seasonal summertime thing.
Absolutely.
And exactly. Looking at it, again, back in the 80s, when I was pregnant, a caftan was just something to cover up. You didn't have to worry about anything. But a fashionable caftan where you still don't have to worry about anything, you know, it's pretty fantastic.
Good. Exactly.
It really is.
So I love it. And yeah, I think it's very chic. It reminds me of the, you know, the show, The Feud with the Truman Swans. They wear caftans a lot. I love
them. They're just flowy. I mean, you can be free in it. You don't have to think about anything else.
Exactly.
So now I want to go back to how you created. You've mentioned that when you talk to people, when you go back to your first gig, not Vogue, but your first entrepreneurship, maternity. Mm-hmm. When you tell people that this was an idea you had, what were people like, oh yeah, that's a great idea?
No. I mean, again, now that I am, you know, in retrospect, an entrepreneur, I would not have used that word about myself back then. Of course not. And I know so many others, and I've spoken at so many business schools and blah, blah, so I get it now. This is the thing. There's never been in the history of mankind a new idea that other people thought was a good idea. If there were, you know, then the whole world would just be creating, you know, would just be entrepreneurs. So when you see something that others haven't seen before, they don't think it's a good idea. So even, you know, when I had this idea and I thought it was such a good idea, I went to my then pregnant friends, the very ones who were telling me they couldn't find a thing to wear. They were spending too much money on designer clothing and they were dying. And I said, great news. I'm going to make a line of maternity clothing. It's going to look like regular clothing. It's going to be expensive, but not as expensive as the designer brands you're wearing. And what do you think? They were all like, oh, no, we don't need that. We make do. No, I don't think so. And then I went to the stores. I went to the big department stores in New York City. And I said, you know, you have these great customers and then they leave for 9 months. What if I made this line of maternity clothing? You could sell it at your stores. Then you wouldn't lose their business for those 9 months. They all said, no, women don't care about what they wear when they're pregnant. They really don't. They won't spend anything on it. So anyway, it's a miracle that I think we entrepreneurs were wired differently. Like I'm a very optimistic person, and I guess I just couldn't hear what the world was telling me. Maybe I'm an idiot. So I just forged ahead anyway. And I said, well, if the stores won't sell it, I'll just sell it to customers myself, but I couldn't afford to open a store. So, and as you said, we could talk about my podcast in a minute, it's not that my family didn't have a lot of money. They did. And so it's not like I was, because I never want, sometimes people interview me and they say, well, it was so brave of you. It wasn't really brave of me. I wasn't going to not have my next meal if the business had failed. But my dad was not looking to bankroll, as he said, like some hobby of mine that he didn't think was a very good idea either. So he was willing to like give me a tiny bit of money for it, which I get is more than most, but I couldn't with that open up a store or anything. So I had a little office. It was in the back of a building, window did not facing the street, a phone, and people could call me and I'd answer and they could make an appointment with me and they could see the clothing. So that's what I had. And I thought, that's the way I'll sell it. I won't let a store get it. You know, if Bergdorf Goodman doesn't want me, well then whatever, I'll sell to customers. And I will say that it became so successful that of course, within 2 years, I had every store asking me if they could sell my maternity clothing. But by that point, I had opened up my own stores and I wasn't interested. So I can't remember what made me tell you that, what the original question was. Hopefully that answered it. Nobody thought it was a good idea.
Right. Nobody. And the thing is, with successful entrepreneurs, usually the idea is not because people haven't thought about it before, they go, well, then it can't be a good idea. I mean, and that's the whole idea and the passion behind an entrepreneur. You have to have a vision, you have to have a passion, and you have to have the chutzpah to go ahead with it. I mean, it takes a lot.
I was young.
Look, you know, don't say that, because at any age, you never know. So Fig is only 3 years old.
You're right. And
and as soon as you do what you think you wanted to accomplish, you might say, okay, now I want something else. There's many, many acts. There's not just three acts. Jane Fonda has called her five acts. I think I've had at least five, if not 10. I mean, everything just turns around. And I always go by what my mother said, you're never too old. I mean, you know, people would come to her and say, oh, you know, I want to get my master's. I want to do something. And she'd say, why aren't you? Oh, I'm 60. And she'd go, get the heck off the phone now and do what you want to do, because that's what she did. So, you know, that's so, when people try to say, nah, well, usually that means that it's because they're jealous. They didn't come up with the idea first.
100%. I feel that way. Absolutely.
So on Fig, this was something it was established as far as you wore their caftans. Mm-hmm. It wasn't an idea that wasn't out there yet. yet look what you're doing with it. You've gone in and expanding it, taking it from one just idea and building on that.
Yeah, I thought it could, you're right. It's not the same as when I started Liz Lang Maternity or even Completely Me by Liz Lang that I did for Home Shopping Network, because these were brand new lines, ideas that I had sort of dreamt up. But Fig, you're right, was a brand that existed, and I could, in my vision, it could be so much more. Like, I felt that it was one thing and it should stay that one thing, but that it could also be much more than that, that, you know, that it didn't just have to be what I would have called back then a brand that was sort of, it's always summer somewhere. Cause I was like, well, you know, it's not always summer where I'm living. And so I think this brand has legs, and it could be, you know, yes, for summer and spring and resort, but also for fall and winter. And that's what we've done. And also, it was known for its bold prints, and we have bold prints, but we also have smaller prints, and we also have solids. And I thought I could take this idea that it's comfortable, that it's glamorous, that it's mostly soft, that it's not, you know, structured clothing, and really, you know, go much, much further with it.
And also hit a larger demographic, hit a larger audience, no matter what the price point is, for people who are 5 feet tall, wearing a caftan can sort of be like, oh, where'd you go? And, you know, but you've brought on other designs. You've brought on, exactly, you know, with the solids, with the smaller prints. It's great. It's colorful. And if you're feeling down, all you have to do is open your closet or go into, you know, one of the stores and go, wow, look, color, prints. Wow. So I think that's absolutely fantastic.
Thank you.
When you had Liz Lang, as opposed to now you have Fig, getting the word out there in marketing was so much different. There wasn't the internet. So what have you done to get the word out there, other than, you know, Fig was, yes, it was a name, to market what you're doing now?
Well, as you said, I mean, maybe the outlets are different, but the concept is the same. So, you know, back then it was about magazines, which really it's barely about that anymore. Huh. It's about magazines. It was about electric media, you know, being on TV, not even so much now. I mean, like, you know, in some ways it was easier because all eyes were on just a few places, and now we're so cluttered. It's hard to make this kind of impact I could make with just one article back then. But, you know, today it's different. So we have an Instagram account. I have my own personal Instagram account. I don't know, it's Liz Lang Official, where I, you know, post all my sort of inspirations and things I find, you know, beautiful and glamorous and chic. And it's about, influencers and dressing them. It's not even really about A-list celebrities anymore. It's almost like anybody could be a celebrity and can be important. But it's about the online version of these magazines as well. So, I mean, it's a little bit, the more things change, the more they stay the same. But I have always believed in marketing, and, you know, it's still something that we're very focused on. But as I said, the outlets are a little different. And podcasts, I mean, did podcasts exist when I had been talking to you back in the early 2000s or late 90s? No, of course not. So, you know, that's all part of it.
The other thing that I wanted to talk about is, you have said that, and I so agree with this, that when you hire people, you can't just hire people who are going to yes you. And you can't know everything. You should have an exposure to every piece of your business, but it's not a bad thing. In fact, it's a pretty good thing to be able to hire people who maybe know more about a particular part of the business. How did you come to that conclusion?
Well, I mean, I think when I started Liz Lang Maternity, I knew that I knew very little. I mean, I knew that I had, you know, I was learning as I was doing. And I do think that's the best form of business school. But as soon as I could afford to be hiring people, I wanted to hire people with expertise who had been trained in areas that I had not been. At the beginning, again, out of necessity, I was doing it all, but pretty soon I realized I could learn a lot from someone who's always been in the field of production, someone that's always been a merchant or a buyer. there's a billion examples, you know, even though I always headed the design team, I have no formal training in design. So I was very pleased to be able to afford to have people working for me that design was what they went to school for, that they could translate my ideas, you know, better than I could even. That was just always very obvious to me. And it remains so. I have a lot of respect for, you know, my employees. And as you said at the outset, I always tell them the last thing I'm looking for is for them to agree with me all the time. Like, you know, like that's not helpful. Like we need to have a debate. That'll get us to the best place. I want them to say, Liz, you're wrong about that. And then they can argue to me why. Maybe I'll still think I'm right. And maybe I'll go with my way, but maybe I won't. So and when I first started, most of the people I hired were older than me. They had been in the industry for a long time. I remember I was hiring a lot of people from Ralph Lauren because Ralph Lauren was such an incredible training ground back then. And, you know, I've learned so much. People always ask like who my mentors were. My mentors were my employees. Like those were my mentors and they remain.
That's fantastic because so many owners of companies are so possessive about everything and they don't understand that if you give people room to grow and to express their ideas and feel like they're a part of the company, the outcome is 150% better than if you're keeping everything to yourself and not letting anyone express themselves or think that they're a part of you're building something and they don't take pride in it.
Absolutely.
So two more things, maybe two.
Okay.
In 2017, you bought Grey Gardens, which I don't know. I mean, I knew about Grey Gardens some time ago because of the connection with Jackie Onassis and Lee Radswell. It's an estate or a house or whatever we call it these days that was totally run down, but it was built by the family, by the Bouvier family. And one of the cousins wound up living there. And it's a riches to rags story instead of a rags to riches. Why Grey Gardens? And I know you've so much life back into it. You've worked with Jonathan Adler, who I absolutely adore. Tell me what inspired you to buy Grey Gardens.
Well, Grey Gardens, as you said, a very famous house because the Maisel brothers, who are famous documentary filmmakers, made a documentary about the movie called Grey Gardens in the 1970s that really took the world by storm and became this huge sort of iconic documentary. Because, as you mentioned, it's about Jackie Kennedy's first cousin and her aunt, a mother and daughter, who were very, very wealthy. They were from a very, very rich WASPY family. Well, I guess Catholic family. And the last name was Beale. And they bought this gorgeous house as their summer cottage. They used to call these houses cottages back then. And through a series of unfortunate events, ended up sort of losing their minds and their money. And lived in this house as it became basically almost condemned by the town. And this is all documented in this documentary. I grew up coincidentally with a house just around the corner in East Hampton. This house, Grey Gardens, is on West End, and I grew up on Lily Pond Lane. And this is a very, very, very beautiful part of East Hampton, basically on the beach. I guess I knew the house. I never gave it a lot of thought. I certainly, like so many people, look up to Jackie Kennedy as a fashion icon, but you know, I really didn't care about owning her house. Like it didn't, it wasn't that. It was that the house was a great, great, great house on a gorgeous piece of land in a fabulous location. And for my purposes, the house actually hadn't been ruined. So many of the houses I grew up near in East Hampton and Southampton have been torn down and replaced with these brand new houses. But this house was restored. It was restored by another very famous couple, Sally Quinn and Ben Bradley. He ran the Washington Post. He broke the Watergate story. And she was his very famous writer and socialite and hostess with the mostest wife. They bought this house from the Beals. They restored it. And then I bought it from them, you know, maybe 20 or 25 years later in the summer of 2017. I knew that it was the perfect house for me because I wanted an old house that I could renovate. I didn't want a new house. I didn't want to build a new house. And so, but this house wasn't in Grey Gardens condition, but it, to be honest, it wasn't in very good condition because Ben Bradley had died. Sally Quinn had stopped really wanting to go to the house. I think probably too many memories. So it had been a few summers since anyone had really lived there, and houses go to seed very, very quickly. So we really took it from the top. And you're right. I worked with Mark Sykes. I worked with my best friend, Jonathan Adler. I worked with the architects, Boris and Sheeran, and also with these other architects of Ferguson Shamamian and the garden designer, Deborah Nevins. And together we sort of reimagined the glory days of Grey Gardens, and I hope brought it back to its sort of former beauty. And I'm, you know, I love the house, but mostly I just love it as a house and a location, you know, right on the beach on a very beautiful street in East Hampton.
Well, you know, the other thing is Edith Bill, who lived there, she was a very unconventional woman. And what you did, how you started out with the maternity line, was very unconventional. So I'd say it's beshared that you have that house now belongs to you and your family.
Well, that's very nice. Little Edie is definitely an inspirational woman. Big Edie was her mom, so there were two Edies. Yes. But Little Edie was definitely a very unconventional woman, and she had a great fashion sense. So,
yes,
you know,
she did. Yes, she did.
So I like that. Thank you. That's great.
And speaking of families, you did a 6 or 8 part podcast you hosted. It was called Just Enough Family, because as we said, you are closely related to the Steinbergs of New York.
Well, I am Liz Steinberg.
I know you are.
Liz Lang is my
That's why you're close. That's why your father was Sol Steinberg's brother. You know, Bob was, you know, so you have a big connection. Can you give us just a brief overview? Because as I said, you know, the Beals, Big Edie and Little Edie, it was a story of riches to rags. Usually it's the other way around. And you've gone from riches to rags to riches. So just, you know, I think it's fascinating.
So, yeah, I mean, as you know, because it is an 8-part series, you probably have to listen to the Just Enough
Family.
Right,
so we would just want a cliff notes.
Hear it. But I'll say that basically I grew up in a family that was very, very well known. My uncle was a very, very famous businessman. And if you said the Steinberg name, certainly in New York City where I grew up, everybody immediately knew. I'm not bragging because, as you said, spoiler alert, we lost the money. So I am not bragging, but I will say that growing up, we were extraordinarily rich. And so I grew up in this very, very privileged life. I always thought it would go on forever. It never crossed my mind, not for a second, that it wouldn't. And yet in 2001, which I kind of call my perestroika year, because it was a year that my family's, you know, business went bankrupt, which again, unheard of for me. I was also diagnosed with cancer. It was just, and of course it was 9/11, which happened to be the same day as a fashion show I was doing for Liz Lang Maternity. It was just a crazy, crazy year. But, you know, like I am a resilient, kind of optimistic person. So luckily I had started Liz Lang Maternity and I was married and things have worked out along the way for me. But it is the story of growing up in that kind of rarefied world and then losing it all. And then maybe, and then, you know, in a very unexpected way, having much more business success than I ever thought possible. And just sort of the story of my life in that, with that as the sort of umbrella.
It happens to be a very interesting story. And not many people can say, you know, a lot of people take a look at those who have a lot of wealth and go, oh, they're so privileged. But as you said, you were privileged you know, you lived a life that you thought it was going to go on forever because, you know, you couldn't imagine that. When it didn't, you were not only resilient, but you persevered and you built your own empire, if you want to call it that. And you took what you believed in and wouldn't let anyone else say no. You knew your father could give you some money to start. Yes, as you said, not everyone's that lucky. But considering the fact what he could give you, he didn't. So, right. And he also was not going to finance you until, you know, forever.
No, I had 2 months.
So
$5,000.
You are resilient. You are a fun and brilliant serial entrepreneur. I know you have a lot to do with Fig right now, but I bet you have more on the plate. Can you give us any idea?
I mean, really, I'm very involved with Fig. As you said, I mean, I run that business and that takes a lot of my time. I've got 2 20-something-year-old children. You know, it's a crazy time, I mentioned this in the podcast, so it's certainly not a secret. I'm Jewish. I'm very connected to Israel. And this has been a crazy few months, as I'm sure, you know, obviously, you know, and I've been, you know, very, very involved in my other free time on working with the different organizations that we are, my husband and I are involved with, that are at this point completely focused on Israel and other Jewish related causes, which is a huge passion of mine. In addition to fashion, that's really, you know, and so
yeah, I get it.
I'd say that's really what's been keeping me busy in these last.
Okay. So you have nothing to do, as I started off the podcast with. Liz, where can people find out more about you and give us the, you know, what websites should we look at?
Well, obviously fig.com, which is spelled strangely. It's F-I-G-U-E. .com. It's the French spelling of Fig, F-I-G-U-E.com. You could follow me on Instagram. I'm Liz Lang Official. And then you can DM me and ask me any questions you want. I always answer everything personally. That's kind of my thing.
I know you do.
That's my thing. And let's see. You could listen to the Just Enough podcast. That's available wherever one listens to their podcasts. You know, I listen on a purple microphone that's on my iPhone, but I think you could listen anywhere. I probably have a Wikipedia page if you Google Liz Lang, but I think the easiest way to reach me is probably fig.com or my Instagram.
Liz, I want to thank you for taking the time today. This has been very interesting and fun. So thank you very much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining me today. If you liked what you heard, please share it with another person you think would be interested. And if you haven't already, please subscribe.
This has been a Life of Prey production.